Well, good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. One members from around Europe. My name's Adrian Lovett. I'm the Europe Director for One, and speaking to you this evening from London. We have members we know from right across the continent who are dialing in as we speak, and I can see from the screen in front of me already many already online. So we're going to get underway. As you know, the Horn of Africa is experiencing one of its worst droughts in 60 years. In some places in South Somalia, the word is famine, and we all know that that's a word that we thought and hoped was something of the 20th century and before. To have famine in the present tense is something that ought to be on all of our consciences and on our minds until we fix the problem. So more than 12 million people severely lacking access to food and water. It's a disgrace in our view that people in the region are once again suffering from famine, and things are going to get worse unless immediate action is taken. The United Nations have issued an appeal for $2.5 billion to respond to the crisis and to prevent millions from dying. But as of today, still a billion-dollar gap remains. We hope that your voice, one member's voice, working alongside millions of others around the world, will help to fill that gap. And we're proud that nearly 130,000 members have already signed our petition to world leaders to step up their crisis. So now on this call, we hope that you'll have a chance to lend your voice in an even stronger way to make sure the funding gap is fulfilled. Tonight we're joined by two speakers. Joining us from Nairobi is Maulid Aden Warfa, the emergency specialist for UNICEF Central and Southern Somalia, where he coordinates the UNICEF emergency response. Maulid just this morning came back from Dadaab in the north of Kenya back to Nairobi, and 24 hours before that was across the border in Somalia, where he's been for some time. Maulid grew up in Somalia and worked for Somali Operation Restore Hope during the 1992 famine, and previously was with the United Nations World Food Program. So he can give us a first-hand account of the problems on the ground, but also how organizations are responding. I'm also very pleased to introduce Commissioner Kristalina Georgieva, and she is the European Commissioner for International Cooperation, Humanitarian Aid, and Crisis Response. Dr. Georgieva studied at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, was a research fellow at the London School of Economics, and held various positions at the World Bank. And she, too, has just been in the region. She recently returned from a six-day mission to the Horn of Africa and has announced €100 million in European Commission aid this year. I'll introduce both of those in just a moment. But first of all, to let you know a bit of technical information, right now all participants are on mute, but you'll have the chance to pose a question to our speakers. What you need to do is to press *3 on your phone, and that will send you into a queue when you'll be connected to a one staff member who'll just check that you're there, write down your question that you'd like to ask, and when we reach your number in the queue, your phone will be live and you can put your question to Maulid or Dr. Georgieva. So we want to kick off, and just to repeat again, that's *3, and you can press that right now if you'd like to put a question. We want to kick off with two questions that we've already received by email before the call began. The first is from the Netherlands, from a one member, Lise Ross. And it's a question to Maulid, and it's about a concern that I know many people share. Lise asked, "It's extremely urgent to increase the food help, but what is also very important is an efficient way to get the help to the people who really need it, without loss of money or food to corruption. How do organizations ensure that doesn't happen?" So let me throw that one first to you, Maulid. Can you answer that?
Hi, good evening, everybody. As Maulid Warfa, I am the emergency coordinator of UNICEF Somalia, and I just got back from Somalia and the Dadaab refugee camp, Kenya. Just to quickly go to the question, it's trade. I'm sure many of you are aware of the situation in the Horn of Africa and specifically to that of Somalia. We are hearing now famine and drought and humanitarian crisis. But I think, just quick background, you need to know Somalia had been suffering for more than 20 years now of conflict, drought, food shortage, access restrictions, and water fuel. And a lot of the social fabric, the things we take for granted on our day-to-day life, like education, healthcare, at least place to go when you're sick, and what if you are gone. And there are children today in Somalia that are more than 20 years old but have never seen police officers street, on the streets, or have never been to school, or do not know what really normalcy is. Quickly, over the past year or two, the situation has deteriorated. There have been extreme restriction of access. As many of you are aware or maybe heard, more than 43 aid workers were killed in south and central Somalia. Another 40 plus were abducted. Many of them are missing today and they're not known. With that extreme difficulties, aid agencies like UNICEF continue to operate and to the maximum operational structures to make sure aid is delivered to those people who are in need. And by the way, today we have one in three children in south and central Somalia malnourished, and we have that's moderately malnourished, and we have one in five children severely malnourished, and five areas in south and central Somalia declared famine, as Adrian had earlier highlighted. With agencies like UNICEF have structures in place. We have a monitoring system that is extremely scrutinized. We receive donations, then we purchase food and other essential supplies like drugs and nutrition supplies, and those are distributed through 70-plus local and international partners UNICEF have on ground. And those agencies do have their own monitoring system. And what I would like to say is the situation in South and Central Somalia is extremely difficult, but it's not hopeless. There's always a hope, and there's a possibility of doing whatever we can to make sure those in need of the aid get to the aid they need. We do implement projects, and we do have teams on ground to do that implementation. And then we do have several layers of monitoring and balance checks to make sure humanitarian principles that are laid out internationally are not compromised. Yes, difficult situation, difficult terrain, very, very risky for aid workers. You can imagine how traumatizing it is to see children are dying in front of us, to see malnourished children. Yesterday, I measured using MWAC measurements a child that's 1 year and a half, and can imagine his upper arm measured only 9 centimeters. She's supposed to be 17 plus centimeters, but now she's gone to that. And if and unless we get the aid she needs, and specifically the nutrition, food she needs, she and many others will die. And we are already saying thousands of them have already died, and many others will die if we do not continue doing what we're doing. Sorry for the long explanation to that answer, but there it is.
Really helpful, Maulid, and I guess the three words that I was hoping to hear and did hear, along with the rest of what you said, was difficult, not hopeless. And that's some reassurance for all of us, I think, listening to you and hearing that very powerful first-hand account. We'll come back to you in a moment, Maulid. I should say also we have on the line our own one director in Brussels, Eloise Todd, who will contribute later on. But she is along with the rest of us, very pleased that we have Commissioner Gail Gaver with us on the line tonight. Commissioner, the question that came in before the call for us was from a one member called Rachel Dalton, who said, what practical steps will the European Commission take to support these countries affected in the Horn of Africa to ensure that such a crisis on this scale never happens again? What's your answer to Rachel?
Let me first say I'm very grateful that you have set up a conversation of this nature. We are facing an extraordinary emergency, and it is heartbreaking that we see our world becoming richer and richer, and yet the 1 billion people that are living in extreme poverty, and of course these are the people who when a drought hits are most vulnerable, there's still 1 billion. This billion hasn't shrunk. So it's an excellent question, not only what we are going to do today, but what we are going to do to have the communities in this part of the world, in other places that are disaster prone, to be more resilient. So today, this is clearly an extreme emergency, and it is absolutely paramount for us to mobilize both money and people that are able to help in a short notice in a difficult environment. From Europe, European citizens have always been very generous when a dramatic crisis hits somewhere around the world, and they are generous again. We now have, from the governments of Europe and from the European Commission, nearly $650 million. Dollars. And I'm giving this number because it is against the dollar call that has been made. And countries continue to raise their funding. Today we have 15 of the European member states contributing. The European Commission, as you said, we have contributed already 100 million euros. We are going to increase this by another 60 million virtually within the next weeks. And if need be, we will bring more, because it is absolutely clear that this is going to be a long-lasting horror for the affected populations. We also need to make this money work for people. In other words, it's not good enough to have the euros and the dollars. We have to have people, organizations capable to operate on the ground. And there what we do, at least from the Commission, I can speak with authority. I just came back, as you said, I just came back from a trip, is to make sure that our resources are in the hands of organizations that are really operating on the ground. We made a conscious choice to fund in Somalia primarily those that have never left, and these are the Red Cross, UNICEF, Norwegian Refugee Council, an organization, COPI, an Italian organization, the Islamic Relief. And by doing so, by giving them resources, they actually have been able to reach to more than 1.2 million people in Al-Shabaab-controlled areas. Not enough, because we know that only in Somalia we're talking about 4 million people. And also we do the same in Kenya and in Ethiopia and in Djibouti, although Djibouti is small and less severely affected. We have a team. We made the choice in the European Commission to increase the number of people who work in hotspot areas, and they are the eyes and the ears of the European taxpayers, back to the question of how you deal with corruption. But they also help us to quickly direct assistance where it is most needed and it would be most effective. So right now, the call has to be to mobilize as quickly and as massively as possible, because lives of people depend on that. People who actually face this tragedy with tremendous dignity, when you talk to families that have walked 25 days, they don't complain. They are grateful that help is there. And they actually say, we are the fortunate, we could move out, we had some resources. And that kind of humbleness is what we all need to recognize, is the kinds of people we are helping are people who deserve that help. But then question comes, what do we do so this doesn't happen again? Because this is not a region that we don't know droughts are going to hit. And with climate change and population growth, droughts will be more frequent, they will be more severe, and there will be more people to suffer from them. So my answer to the question that our friend posed is, development is the best resilience. It is paramount that we work much harder on making sure that countries at all levels, at the level of the governments of the countries, but also at the local level, that there is a focus on building resilience, focus on preparing for braving for a world that is going to be harsher. And I can say this, when this is done, it works. I visited a district in northern Kenya called Moyale. It is a small district squeezed between the most severely impacted areas, right next to Turkana, right next to Wazir. Now, this district is doing much better. The malnutrition rates among kids are twice as low as in the neighbors. Why? Because there, the local leadership, the international community, they have actually worked in the last couple of years to build resilience, and the results are there. So we can do it, but for that we need to be much more focused on the question of how communities can be more resilient in the future.
Thank you, Commissioner. Really, really great to hear your opening words, and both with the sense of the challenge, but also, as you just said there, that actually we can do this. You know, that it can be done. We can reach these people, many, many, many more of them, with the right political will and resources. Okay, we're going to go to the phones. Before I do that, just to remind you, if you want to put a question, it's *3 on your phone. You'll still be able to hear the call, but you'll be connected to one of our volunteers here at One, who will try and connect you into the conversation. So *3 on your phone. And someone who's done just that is Victoria Amazuo, who is in Ireland. Victoria, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi, Victoria.
Yes, I'm on the line.
Thanks for joining the call. What would you like to ask?
Yeah. Actually, I'm excited hearing what the lady said, because originally I'm an African. And it pains me terribly when I see my people are dying over there. Actually, I would like the government, the African government, time has come for them to buckle up, because they have the resources and the manpower. But corruption, I think, is the basic problem we're having over there in Africa. If the world leaders, maybe the European countries should maybe speak to our leaders, because I think they're not doing enough. Like the lady said, they need resources from the government. I'm a serious member of CONSIGN. A lot of money is being given to Africa, but I think the money are not used wisely. Time has come for them to start using the manpower and the resources they've got and the one given to them judicially, so that people will not continue to suffer and die. Being a mother, seeing children crying for common food, it's heartbreaking. It is.
Yeah, thanks, Victoria. Who'd like to react to that? Let me ask Maulid first. What are your reflections on Victoria's thoughts?
Thanks, Victoria, and I'm glad you understand what we're going through, being an African from this part of the world. I think a lot could have been done, and I'm very grateful we have the commissioner today, and I'm extremely delightful on how she explained. I think we are in this part of the world where things what people need are not there, but people are still not giving up. They still have the hope, and they still have the morale and courage to continue surviving. And I think it's true, if the right development strategies are implemented, what we're going through today would not have been the case. But having said that, not every country is in the same position. Somalia specifically is, I think, left behind the rest of the world. 20 years of no government, and what a few. I don't even know who to blame. The current transitional federal government, which is internationally backed government, but very, very weak, does not have the capacity to do any. I don't think they can even take the responsibility that on their shoulders to respond to the current crisis we have, let alone setting up development agendas for the future. Yes, I totally agree with what she said.
Thank you. Commissioner, yeah.
If I could just make 2 points. First, I am so glad to hear somebody saying governments in Africa have responsibilities towards their people. Right now, for example, the Kenyan government spends only 0.5% of their health budget, which is 10% of their budget, to address malnutrition among kids. And yet malnutrition among kids in Kenya is a big problem without the drought. It is costing, my former institution, the World Bank, said it would cost the Kenyan economy 3% of GDP that kids are not growing healthy and strong and smart. So we do have a responsibility to talk about these issues in an honest and direct way, and also as donor community, not only as Victoria was suggesting, we have a responsibility when we provide funding to be sure that money is used for the benefit of people. That is absolutely true. But we also have a responsibility to make sure that governments don't take donor money for granted and then substitute their own responsibility with what donors could and will do. And that is a conversation that we need to take seriously, because the future is not going to be easy for this part of the world. And there are many communities who today, I talked to an elderly man, maybe in his 80s, and I asked him about the drought. This is in Moyale in Kenya. He says, has never seen anything like this, 5 years in a row. His own cattle is up in Ethiopia because pasture there is a little better. And he says, well, maybe we need to just walk out of what we have been doing. Maybe the world has changed so much that there is no future for us as pastoralists. Who is going to help this man and his sons answering this question? Clearly, there is a responsibility for all of us, for the governments and for the international community to work on it.
Thanks, Commissioner, and many thanks to Victoria for bringing in that very powerful perspective. We're going to stay in Ireland. Ireland is very activated on this call this evening, and we're going to go to John Rogers. John, can you hear us?
Hello, yes, I can hear you.
Hi, John. Hi, John. Thanks for joining the call. What's your question?
Well, my question is, as an Irish citizen, as a citizen of the European Union, what can I do as an individual that would effectively help these people in Mali and surrounding countries? What can I do? Of course, I can donate money, I can donate funds, but that always feels like a drop in the ocean as to what's required. Is there something that I can do on a political level and on a local level that can help this problem?
Commissioner Gail-Gaber, the One Campaign has an answer for you, John, but I'll save that for a minute. Commissioner.
I strongly believe that people like you who are keenly interested have a big role to play. And I see it primarily in how the climate change discussion is going to shape up in the future, today and in the future, and how politically we can finally move it more towards vulnerability and adaptation. Still in Europe, when we talk about climate change, we talk about mitigation mainly, and a little bit about adaptation, and yet climate change is already here. And unless we get the political sense to recognize that no more we are talking about the problem of the future, we are talking about the problem of today, and there has to be much stronger focus politically to move the world towards, obviously a negotiated solution would be great, but if we don't have it, at least to take the actions, practical actions that are possible to relieve the pressures and the risks, especially on the most vulnerable communities. And here is the thing about climate change that breaks my heart. Who caused it? certainly not this pastoralist in Kenya. But who suffers most? It is the poorest communities, the most vulnerable countries. And we have a responsibility to speak about that and to raise the attention politically on what needs to be done today, so the risks on these people, that on a problem they did not cause, that the risk on them is lessened.
Thanks, Commissioner. We're going to keep the calls coming because there's a lot of people that want to put questions. So I'm going to go now to Joanna Pereira. Joanna, can you hear us?
Hi, yes.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, if the government have a long-term schedule to prevent it from happening again, to know what they are thinking of doing so the countries can grow up and stay the way.
Let me throw that first to Maliid. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I think with their little ways, most of the countries in the region are trying their best. And I think, of course, we know they're not really empowered in terms of resources and they are also facing a lot of challenge. But I think they're trying their best. But for sure, they're not on the... On what we would have all expected for them to be. Corruption, as Ali highlighted, is massive. Nepotism and a lot of poor management of resources are also rampant in most part of the continent in Africa where we are now. And there are a lot of other challenges of climate change and other ongoing and regular. I think it's becoming now regular natural disasters that are coming in. In for example, Somalia and Ethiopia and Kenya, we now from one drought to flood, from flood to drought, from drought to flood. So we kind of going through a vicious cycle of natural disasters compounded with poor political structures and you know, lack of adequate resource to deal with that.
Thank you. I'd like to take another question. We're going to South Africa now, beyond Europe's borders, well beyond, of course. Farai Blessing Manatsi. Farai, what's your question?
Yes, my question, I've got two questions here. My first question would be, I just want to know if there is anything that is the countries of the world doing to actually try and bring stability in Somalia. To stop war, the civil war in Somalia. Because we can talk of drought today, but it's not, as I see it, it's not the main problem. The main problem is because there is war in Somalia, and most of the productive people have actually ran out. They are actually scattered in the whole world, in other countries. And those people, they're supposed to be in that country and try and make sure, I mean, they build their own country. But because of war, I mean, now we have drought and with war on top. What we were seeing on TV, it was even the gift of the givers who were trying to were in Somalia recently to try and help people who are actually dying of hunger. It was even dangerous for them to be in that country. So the problem, first problem is war. And then my second question would be, is there any measures that has been put in place or that are being put in place to actually mobilize some of the Somali nationals who are actually in other countries? Like, for example, we have South Africa here. We've got a lot of Somalis here in South Africa. And most of the Somalis who are here in South Africa, most of them, they're actually running very successful businesses. And then my question is there anything that is being done to mobilize those people so that they also send a food home? Because as we see it, I'm here in South Africa, as I see it, it's like you know, for most of the Somali nationals, it's like, I mean, one man for himself and God for us. Oh, they're running their business, and it's like it seems that they're forgotten about what is happening at home. So is there anything being done to mobilize those people so that they send also food back home?
Thanks very much, Frey. Great questions. So let's throw the first one of those, first of all, about the conflict in Somalia, Commissioner, to you.
It is very clearly, finally, a wake-up call for all of us that the world, not only the Somali people, the world cannot afford to have a failed state there. What is being done today is mostly to support the parts of Somalia where there is a better local governance, Somaliland and Puntland, and to support the transitional government. But as Malit already said, the transitional government still has a long way to go to gain control over big chunks of territory, and the south of Somalia, where the famine is most severe, is not by and large under their control. So what I'm very hopeful for is that finally there would be more attention focused on Somalia. The Al-Shabaab left some of the district they controlled in Mogadishu. What does that mean is too early to say, but certainly there is an opening for the transitional government and for the international community and for the Somalis themselves to be more demanding for peace to return. And if I can just say on the second question, I was very impressed how much now many of the chiefs, the local chiefs, are saying enough is enough. We do not want Al-Shabaab to keep help away from us. And when you ask about Somali diaspora, the organizations that stayed in Somalia are mostly successful because they have local Somali staff and because they have mobilized people from the Somali diaspora. And if we are to be hopeful, this hope can only be built on mobilizing people, Somalis, to be more engaged and braver in this environment to return, and to hope that the local chiefs are going to actually push the extremists out and bring the needed stability for a more serious engagement with Somalia in the next months.
It was fascinating. Something I read this morning, I think a World Bank report that said that even in normal times, I think 4 in every 10 euros, if you like, that is the income of people, at least in urban parts of Somalia,
comes from yeah, exactly. The diaspora has been very critical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Maulid, you're a Somali yourself. What's your take on this?
Actually, I'm a Somali Ethiopian. I was born in Ethiopia.
Oh, sorry.
I grew up in Somalia. No, very quick one. I think what's the world doing for Somalia? I think there are two levels. First of all, there has to be kind of a stable mind from the Somali people themselves, and to that extent, the Somali elite and the people who are now running the political front of Somalia, and then genuine international support. If we get these two, I think the problem of Somalia could be dealt with. I will leave it there. What is the diaspora doing? Somalia, can they be mobilized? For the past 20 plus years of the conflict, the diaspora and the Somali people outside had been the biggest single donor to the Somali conflict. We had some studies that suggest up to $2 billion from the diaspora come to Somalia every year. And the system, the economic system in Somalia, is being stabilized by the dollars that are coming from the diaspora people. There was another study done a few years ago that 80% of construction inside Somalia due to the money coming from the diaspora. And they are actually doing a great job. There are so many Somali shows that are happening in Europe and other parts of the world, and already Somali people are coming in as a group to become a partner with aid agencies to do their part in responding to the crisis. So we were very hopeful. They are not ignoring their people, and they're doing a great job.
Yeah, something that we at One have been doing is engaging very actively with the Somali diaspora communities, particularly in Europe and also in the United States. And One's co-founder, Bono, on his recent U2 tour within Minneapolis, which is home to many, many Somali diaspora members, and was joined there by Kanan, who many people on the call will know. Yeah. Great Somali, you know him, Malid. Great Somali artist, musician. Yeah, and he's become a great champion for One, and more specifically for this crisis and for resolving this crisis. And I know he's actually just this evening going live on CNN with Bono to talk about this and raise awareness of the crisis in the U.S. and beyond. Star 3 is the button to press, star and then 3 if you'd like to ask a question. We have still a few more minutes, so if you want to try and get a question in, now's the time. And I think we're going to go now to Sweden. And in Sweden, we have Jill Rose. Jill, hi, are you there?
Hi, thank you. I understand that in Somalia there has previously been a complete breakdown in all functions of society and this terrible war raging, and it's very tragic to hear of the death of the aid workers, and I think probably most of us understand it's been an extremely dangerous situation to try and organize relief. But my question now, if you recall in Darfur, it was the United Nations who finally took the responsibility for negotiation, a stable situation there. And my question is, which organization bears responsibility for negotiating with the military groups to ensure continued peace and stability in the north of Somalia, and hopefully that they will withdraw from the central and southern parts as well? And the linked question is, why is the harbour, which apparently is functioning, not being used to get supplies in quickly to Somalia? And is that linked to the problem of pirates? In which case, my question is, which organisation has the responsibility for trying to negotiate peaceful passage?
Thank you. Thanks very much for that question. Quite specific, Commissioner Gogova. What can you say on those points?
In Somalia, in the northern part of Somalia, over this period of time when there was great instability, some stability reemerged under the leadership of the local, let's call them clans in Somaliland and in Puntland. And there, the big question is, the aspiration of these two regions of Somalia is to break out of Somalia, and of course it is very difficult for me, I'm not a Somali expert, to say, but that may also be a source of instability. But then when you go to South Central, Al-Shabaab is actually not a monolithic entity. Al-Shabaab is like a dragon with many heads, and you need to negotiate with each one of the heads separately. And what has happened is the organizations that stayed, as you know, 18 humanitarian organizations were expelled between 2008 and 2010, but a small number stayed, and those that stayed, they negotiated with the local chiefs and the local communities, and they would say, when I talked to them, they would say, our security are the local people. We deliver for them, they protect us. And I actually saw a local chief virtually sitting during food distribution to make sure the distribution is fair. So unfortunately, there isn't one entity that can negotiate with one entity, with somebody across the table. And at the moment, probably the most important task for all of us is to focus on using the existing channels to distribute help as quickly and as effectively and efficiently as possible. But then when time comes for negotiated solution,
The world has pinned its hopes on the transitional government. It has not delivered so far. Would be interesting to see whether the famine has changed the dynamics. Would be interesting to see whether the more moderate parts of Al-Shabaab would like to reach some kind of agreement and then stick to it, and what that would mean for the stability in the country. As for the international community, the UN, of course, is the one that is legitimately involved and engaged there, as is the African Union. And theirs is actually the biggest role so far in as it comes to retaining some peacekeepers inside Mogadishu. And they will continue to play a very important role. So the summit that is going to take place on August 25th in Addis Ababa is going to be quite important in terms of seeing whether there can be a new momentum for negotiations in a peace to be broken in Somalia. And as for the food and the port, the World Food Program is the one that has the most substantial capacity to deliver food. They have been doing airlifts because high nutrition was very much necessary, and so has been doing UNICEF, for that matter, delivering via air. But there are ships, and Atalanta is there to protect ships to be able to reach ports. This is a very good question. What more can be done? I will take it and follow up both with the World Food Program and Atalanta.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Twitter. We've got quite a bit of tweeting going on about this call at the moment, and there's one come in from Belen in Spain. She says, great conference call. Maybe somebody could talk about food prices being pushed up by financial speculation. There's a good question. I'd like to throw that to both of you. Let me start with you, Maleed. What are you seeing of the impact of changes in food prices on the ground, and what difference is that making?
No, the food crisis, the global food prices actually has been part of what triggered this final kind of stage of the crisis in southern central Somalia. Practically in Somalia, 60% of the consumption of the food people eat comes from outside. It's imported, and only 40% of it is grown up. Is grown locally. Of late, or last 2 years, the local production went down to 20%, and because of the poor capacity of the people to purchase food, and because of the commercial food itself not being easily moving across the country, the prices have gone very, very high, and in some areas, our FSNAU, Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit, have reported in areas up to 200% and 300% increase of the food prices. And what that does is many of the bottom part of the society will not have the capacity to buy food and then will stay without food. I just want to go back quickly on the issue of negotiation, because it's a field I personally involved, and just want to explain how we're dealing with the people who are working inside Somalia. I am trying to avoid calling them Shabab, but we call them many state entities, and this is what I'm calling many state entities are the Shabab. Specifically for UNICEF, we've been one of the few agencies, or at least maybe one of the last UN agencies that stayed in Somalia, specifically in southern central Somalia, and who have been operating throughout the zone. And that's the southern central Somalia, which is where the crisis of the current emergency is centered. We have a small group, just give you how we do the work. We have a small group of core group. We five. I actually chair the committee, and then we use the partners. These are our national partners, and we use the traditional elders, as the commissioner highlighted. And then through the use of those committees, and through persistent call to the many state entities, we manage to negotiate things. They sometimes come up with some unacceptable, ridiculous demands, but then we say, no, that doesn't work. If you don't do this, or if you want to continue pushing this, we're not going to operate in this area, and then we will leave. And then because UNICEF deals with things like water, therapeutic food stuff, helps the MCH and other places where people see as a central to their life, it becomes very difficult for anybody when the elders go, when the partners go, when the women groups. And I must say, in Somalia, one of the strengths we have is they are very, very powerful women groups, and there are some powerful mothers who can take a stick and say it to anyone. And using those groups, we manage to continue finding our way through the highly malnourished children. And just to say very quickly, we've been able, since the beginning of July, to charter more than 11 flights with 42.5 metric ton of, ready-to-use therapeutic food. And we've been able also to send 3 ships into Mogadishu and 35 trucks carrying total of 2,000 metric ton of nutrition supplies and other essential supplies. And we're trying to reach at least 2 million children with measles vaccine. And we're trying our best. But what is important now is we are in a crisis that requires massive response. And that massive response can only come if we get a political will to support. And that's one thing I think the earlier caller who said, what can I do from Ireland, can use the social network and other channels to influence politicians to have the interest of dealing with the crisis we are in now. So
yeah.
I think.
Malid, I want to jump in just to thank you. Yeah, very very good to hear. Now I'm going to bring in 2 more questions. We are just about out of time, but if our panel here are willing, I'll just take a couple more minutes, if we may. We'll take the 2 questions together. I'm going to go to Mina Cheney, who's in France. If you'd put your question, Mina, go ahead.
Hi, good evening. Thank you very much for taking my call. Actually, I know that, as Adrian said right now, there is a $1 billion funding gap, and I wondered how the European Commission plans to fill this gap, and if they're optimistic. Thank you.
Okay, that's one question, and Commissioner, that one is coming your way. I'm going to take another one as well, and we'll do these 2 together, if we may.
I want to hear.
Hold on just one moment. So we're going to Germany this time to Joanna Haverman. I think we're just trying to get her on the line. Joanna, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Great. What's your question, Joanna?
Hi. I was wondering, also from Kenyan media, that there are some regions in the southwest Mali where there's quite good harvest and food is actually rotting on the fields. And I know that many organizations are trying to buy local, and maybe it's also connected to the difficulties with infrastructure and all that. But what can you tell me about the current situation to use the food which is at place, more or less, to combat the crisis in the north?
So thank you, Joanna, for that question. The line was a little bit hard, so let me try and just repeat that. So you're asking about the reports that there's been an excellent harvest in the south of Kenya, but the farmers there are supposedly having to sell under price, crops are rotting in the fields, and is this something that's being addressed? So that's one question I think I'll give to you, Malid, and then we'll come back to the commissioner for the earlier question from Mina in France. Malid.
But I'm not sure if that is the case. We are in a region where there's constant food shortage, and I don't think there's a lot of food getting rotten in the warehouses. some few months ago, there was some harvest in Kenya, and I heard through the media there was some debate between the Kenyan farmers and the Kenyan Minister of Agriculture. That's the agent that buys the local local cereals. I'm not really in a position to explain that, but I can tell you agencies like WFP and others are looking for cereals, and if there was a harvest, surplus harvest in Kenya, that would have been a perfect source of you know, market to buy. But I don't think there's a lot of food in the market that's getting broken, okay. That I'm
good
not
to,
aware of.
Good to hear that perspective. So, Commissioner, are you optimistic?
I'm relatively optimistic that we will fill the gap. Just 2 points. One is that already from the Commission, as I mentioned, we are going to increase our contribution with 60 more million euros. This is close to 290 plus million dollars. We are constantly in contact with member states, urging those who can contribute more. I mean, we have some member states that have been wonderful in coming early and with significant contributions, like UK and Sweden and now in France and Denmark. The question is how to encourage more to do others to do more. But secondly, what I'm seeing in the last days is a more active contribution from the emerging donors. And that is something for us to encourage. With more wealth comes more responsibility. Where I'm more worried is turning this money into help that reaches people fast and also sustaining the attention to the problem as long as it is necessary. And from the Commission, I can give you this pledge. We have leaned forward from the beginning of this crisis. We will continue to do so. We are leading in terms of contributions, and as much as necessary, we will make sure that Europe is there to help people. From the Commission, as much as necessary, as much as our partners can absorb, we will make sure that we raise the money so people don't die unnecessarily. Would you allow me to make one more point?
Of course, please.
Okay, that goes to the food prices question. We are going to live in a world where food prices unlikely would turn down. So what we are having is growing middle class. By some estimates, 2 billion people are now middle class around the world. High energy prices because of high demand in emerging markets. And then we have erratic weather as a result of climate change. So when demand is high, there is also speculation, and I think it is critical to cut the legs of speculation in the food markets. And that is, I mean, we don't have time to debate it how it can be done, but it is a very critical point to make. So we don't afford in the food market the same thing that is happening in the financial markets, because in this case, it would be the most vulnerable, the poorest people, to pay the highest price.
Thank you, Commissioner. Very, very interesting stuff. We are almost out of time. I want to bring in our one advocacy director, our director in Brussels at the European Commission, who is Eloise Todd. Eloise, what's your reflections on what you've heard?
Great to hear the Commissioner positive and saying that, Commissioner, you're in constant contact with member states. We need a bit of a forcing moment. This is a race against time. So what can we do in the next month? Can you put this on the next General Affairs Council agenda in September? Can we urge our supporters, our wonderful One members, to coalesce around that and contact their governments and urge them to do more? Because we know that some can do a lot more. Can you pledge to do that? And let's stay in touch about all the other things that we can do to fill that funding gap and get Europe's already good contribution up beyond the billion-dollar mark.
We are going to have a discussion first in COHAF immediately in September, and I have already started sending a second round of letters to Members' Parliament, the European Parliament, and to Member States, on where we are, what the funding gap is, what we can do. I am pretty sure that we will have discussions at the Foreign Affairs Council. Interesting point to put it on the agenda of the General Affairs Council. That is not normally where these issues would come, but I will follow up with my team and see what we can do about it. And don't get me wrong, I don't think the job is done. Where I'm more optimistic is because I have been following up the increase of commitments over the last 2 weeks, and it has been impressive from Europe. But please, we have now 15 member states contributing. We have 12 more member states that we can urge to do more. And even those that have contributed generously, if the crisis is long-lasting, we need their good hearts. We need their strong voices so we can meet the needs of people in the region.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. And one thing that one will be doing. Yes, just a quick comment, Malik. Yes, please.
No, I just want to just pick up where the Commissioner has just left. I think we're in August, in early August. And talking of Somalia, the first rain is not before October, and the first harvest is not before January 2012, if it rains in October. And if it doesn't rain, we're not talking about any grain or any harvest before June or July 2012. And I think the situation is extremely bad. And as much as we're very, very grateful to the funding we've received so far, if we do not receive adequate funding, a lot of people will die. And I think it's one thing for the countries to contribute, but there's a lot that individuals, the good people, people with good heart can also do. So I am urging and I'm actually appealing to anybody who's listening to do as much as they can, influencing or personal donation or whatever they can to open their heart and put their hand in their pocket.
Thank you so much, Maulid. And in fact, you've helped me out a little there with that, with those comments, because I do want to recognise Peter Pringle in Ireland, who is the person who I'm afraid we're not able to get to, but who's been waiting longest. But the question he wanted to ask was about, as well as donating to charities, what else can people do? And Maulid, I think you just answered that for him. We haven't managed to get to quite a number of other people. I'm sorry to Sylvia from Austria, to Marius from Romania, Tiziana from Italy, Anand, who I'm not sure where Anand is from, it doesn't say here, but thank you to all those. I'm sorry for those we weren't able to get to. One is, as you know, doing everything we can as a movement of people around Europe and around the world to try to ensure that as many lives as possible are saved in the short term, and to ensure that we never see another crisis like this again. As we said right at the start of this call, this shouldn't be happening in 2011. It's a scandal that it is, and it's shameful to all of us, whether policymakers or ordinary citizens of Europe or beyond, that this is continuing in the 21st century. Europe has been a leader historically in responses to crises like this. But unfortunately, so far, this famine hasn't generated the support that we often see from tsunamis and earthquakes. So we do need action in the short term and the long term. And we need our ONE members to use their voices to call on every country to pledge its fair share. So for those that are on the call, we would really encourage you to add your voice. You've done so by being part of this call today. Go online to one.org and find out the other ways that you can get involved, and stay with us through Twitter, through Facebook, through the website, to keep up to date with what's happening next. Tomorrow we'll be publishing our own assessment that we've done with some very clever economists on what each country in not just Europe but other richer countries around the world should really be expected to pay towards this crisis, and there's some interesting results that are going to come through. There are some that are doing well, there are some that are clearly not doing well and need to do a great deal more. So we'll be talking a lot about that tomorrow. Now, before we finish, two things. You'll have a chance, if you're on the call, to leave a personal message to European leaders before you hang up. So don't hang up yet. Stay on the line. You'll be connected to a voicemail box where, if you want to, you can leave your message in support of this call for action on the Horn of Africa. Finally, I just want to say a huge thank you to Maulid Aden Wafa and Commissioner Georg, Kristalina Georgieva. I was getting that right, Commissioner, all the way through the call, and I almost left it there.
You did very well.
Thank you very much. Seriously, thank you so much to both of you. You've given up a lot of your time, and I think I'm sure I'm speaking for everyone who's been on the call to say that what you gave us was terrific insight into both the political challenge at the heart of Europe to get mobilized support behind efforts to solve this crisis, and the reality on the ground, which, of course, in the end, is what it's all about. Maulid, you said it's difficult, not hopeless. Commissioner Georgieva, you said development is the best resilience, and that, I guess, is the answer that points towards the long-term solutions that we at One think are so important, as well as the very, very urgent need for short-term response. So thank you to both of our speakers. Thank you to all of you who've called in. We'll do this again. I think this has gone well, and we'd like to make this a bit of a regular occurrence. So look out for more news, and go online to one.org to find out how you can stay involved with this campaign. Many thanks.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.